Richard, you have shared the 2017 Chemistry Nobel Prize with Jacques Debouchet and Joachim Frank for the development of the cryo-EM methodology for the determination of the structure of biomolecules with atomic resolution. Can you briefly explain what is structural biology?
So structural biology started about 1926 or 1927, when there were scientists here in Cambridge in the physics department. So William Asprey and J.D. Bernal were young scientists then, and they decided to begin by shining X-ray beams at biological structures, either crystals of biological molecules or fibrous structures. And they sort of kicked it off, and it's believed that's how structural biology started. And it was defined then as, and it has grown, of course, to be the study of the structure of all the molecules in biology using various methods, initially X-ray crystallography, but then other methods like electron microscopy, nuclear magnetic resonance spectroscopy have come in. So these technical methods are used to dissect and analyze the structures so that you can then understand what it is that makes the whole of biology tick because of the molecules that are underlying all the processes. So that's the core of structural biology. The first time structural biology was used as a term was about 1960. Don Casper created a department and he put structural biology on the door. But now we all say we are structural biologists because it's been a very successful method. There's now hundreds of thousands of structures and thousands of people doing structural biology.
What is cryo-EM in a nutshell?
So of the three methods that are the principal methods in structural biology, electron microscopy itself started about 1930 when it was realized you could focus electrons and make images just like you do with light that you focus with a lens. So the first lenses were developed in the 1930s. And then the difficulty with electron microscopy, electrons only pass through a vacuum. If you have them in air, they scatter and then you can't image them. They get scattered and then it would be very blurry. In the early stages of electron microscopy, people could only look at structures that had heavy metal stains on them, so uranium, platinum, things like that. And so the early progress of electron microscopy was all in material science and so on. It wasn't till later that people started looking at biological structures. And the problem with biological structures, they are made up of organic molecules, so carbonaceous material. You put the beam of electrons on them, they get damaged, bonds break, they get ionized, so you get radiation damage and they fall apart. So all the early work in structural biology was done with either metal shadowing or negative stain, but it was realized that if you could freeze the specimens down to a very low temperature so that the atoms wouldn't move, the structures would be preserved. So you can freeze structures and then you can thaw them out and the enzymes are alive, cells are still alive. The development of electron cryomicroscopy didn't start till about 1980 when methods were developed by Jacques Debouchet, the person who shared the 2017 Chemistry Nobel Prize. They developed ways of freezing them. And so what you do then is you make a thin film of your biological molecules embedded in amorphous ice, and then you put the electron beam through it, collect it with a lens, and make images. So you're just magnifying images of the biological molecules without any use of metal stains. You're looking at the molecules, the atoms, carbon, nitrogen, oxygen, hydrogen, the atoms that make up the biological molecules, and then you get an image, just like if you take a photograph of us with light, you take a photograph of the molecules with electrons, and then you can see them. They've just been magnified a million times. Now, there's 10 microscopes. So we have to find one. Here we have a 20-year-old electron microscope. It can do either normal specimens, or we can put into here a cold stage and do electron cryomicroscopy. At the very top of the microscope, there is a field emission electron gun source. Then there are a couple of lenses that illuminate the specimen to the level here. And then at this level and below, there are three or four more lenses that magnify the image of the specimen. You can look down the binoculars and you can see it on the screen. At the moment, there's not a specimen in there, so that's just a homogeneous beam. Or you can lift the screen like this, and then the beam goes down onto this electronic detector, and then that you would see on the TV screen here. And then it would be recorded onto disk, just like a digital camera, and then go into the computer and be processed to give you the image that we all want to get.
An outsider to the field would normally ask, are you doing SEM or TEM? So yes. Why do you call it cryo-EM instead of cryo-TEM?
So electron microscopy originally, it wasn't clear what the best way of using the electrons to make the images to see what you're interested in better than you can see with light. So the difference between what they call transmission electron microscopy, TEM, and scanning electron microscopy, SEM, is that in transmission electron microscopy, the electrons go all the way through the sample, they get scattered, and then you image, and the molecules also, they don't absorb the electrons, they only scatter them. It alters the phases of the electron waves. And so you're imaging essentially by looking through a transparent object. The biological molecules are transparent, but you get the modulation of the electron beam, the phase contrast. Whereas scanning electron microscopy, you put the electrons on the specimen and you look at the ones that are backscattered. So you can look at a solid object. So one of them is transmitted and the other one is reflected. And the different characteristics of SEM and TEM mean that SEM is good for sort of big objects. You don't get very high resolution. You have to cover it usually with metal. So in structural biology, SEM is used as a sort of diagnostic tool, but it's not very powerful. Transmission electron microscopy, you can go in principle to one very, very high resolution, get very detailed pictures of all the atoms. And so in our field, basically SEM is not a strong candidate. It doesn't really exist. And so we just say we are electron microscopists, or better, we like to call ourselves structural biologists, because then that doesn't mean that you have to say, I am doing X-ray crystallography. So now most structural biologists, they can go back and forward between all the different methods. One big debate is whether we should, when we have the specimen cold, liquid nitrogen temperature, should we call it electron cryomicroscopy? Or some people say cryo-electron microscopy. You're just saying it's cold, but it's the specimen that's cold. The electrons are actually hot. They come out at 2,000 degrees. So we prefer electron cryomicroscopy, but cryo-EM is okay.
You have been working at the LMB since the 70s. Can you tell us what makes this place unique?
When I was an undergraduate, I was in Edinburgh doing physics. And I looked into where physics was going, and I thought, actually, from all of the different types of physics, particle physics, solid state physics, you know, fusion research to produce unlimited power and so on, I thought biophysics might be something that you wouldn't need a team of 1,000 people. You know, the gravitational wave discoveries recently, they needed 1,000 people, you know, all over the world. It costs thousands of millions. But in biophysics, you can do work with yourself or one or two people and so on. So I thought that was a good idea. So I looked around in the UK. I didn't want to go abroad and hadn't quite decided, but I went to talk to the physics professor in Edinburgh, who was called Bill Cochrane. And he said, I don't think you should go to Norwich or London or Oxford. He said, you should write to Max Perutz, who was the first director of the MRC Laboratory of Molecular Biology. And when I came here, it was in 1966, and it was on a Saturday, and everyone is working. I thought, this is marvelous. So I said, okay, I'd like to come as a student. I came, and then I went away as a postdoc, came back in 1973, and I keep looking around for good labs. but I still haven't found a better one. And so it's grown also. It's grown from there were about 70 or 80 people in 1966. It had started, it had been founded in 1960 by the merger of the biophysics group from the Cavendish, which was Francis Crick, John Kendrew, Max Perutz, and so on, and the more biochemically oriented group from the biochemistry partnership, Fred Sanger, Brian Hartley, Jan Harris, and so on. So there was a merger of two groups from two different Cambridge University departments who didn't like the molecular biologists. They wanted them to go. So they said, please leave. And so they got money from the MRC, built a new building, and then they recruited people also from London, Aaron Klug, Hugh Huxley came from London. And so it was a new lab created from people who had a clear research plan, a clear vision. And so it was a very good lab in the 60s. And many people predicted it would just die out because as the second generation, obviously the first generation are great. And they had 6 months after the lab opened, they had four Nobel Prize winners that 1962. But the critics said the second generation, they will be less talented scientists than the founders. And then the third generation will be even worse, and then eventually it'll just disappear. But actually, the opposite has happened. What has happened is the founders attracted good people, and it's continued to... So now it went from sort of 70 or 80 people. It's now up to 500 or 600 or something like that, and is really quite productive. And we really get... Or the lab really gets very good students, postdocs, and young group leaders now. And it's not necessarily because they're recruited. It's because they have noticed the lab, they've identified it, and they think, well, you know, this would be a good place for them to work, just like I. So it's now that's 53 years for me, to me. So, but I'm kind of trying to retire now. So the younger ones are obviously working harder, and they're full of good ideas. So there's still a long way to go in terms of... it's a medical research council lab, so we're supposed to have our eye on medical research, but often... really important revolutionary treatments for, you know, say human welfare or in agriculture and so on. They often come not because you're working on liver cancer or something like that. You're working on some basic biology and you don't realize that it will have an impact on a much wider area. So I think a lot of the work in the lab is basic biology that develops completely unknown ideas that do revolutionary improvements in health and wealth rather than evolutionary improvements. And so that still seems to be happening.
One of the big questions since the early days was how can we resolve the atomic structure of biomolecules using TEM? Can you briefly summarize the aspects that needed improvement in order to go from a resolution of 7 angstroms to 3.5 angstroms?
So obviously it goes back to, you know, in the 1930s, we had the first electron microscope. Everything about it was very crude. The electron source was crude. The lenses were crude. The way you record the images were crude. And so you had to have this heavy metal stains. And it was very, very low resolution, if you like, a sort of very distant view of the molecules. You couldn't see atoms. You could barely see biological molecules at all. You could see viruses and bacteria because they were very big. And so many, many things, say from 1930 to 1950, many things had to be improved. And I guess if we jump to the current day, we do have now electron cryomicroscopy that works at 1 or 2 angstrom resolution, the underlying theoretical limits are the same. So all of the improvements were practical ones. So for example, if you want to put a specimen into the vacuum of an electron microscope and cool it down to liquid nitrogen temperature, so minus 196 Celsius, so that the water molecules don't move around, and so that amorphous ice doesn't recrystallize into normal hexagonal ice that you get in snowflakes, you have to have a very cold temperature. If you did that right up to about 1980, the specimen would immediately get covered with a contaminating layer of ice that was extracted out of the bad vacuums of the microscope. So the very first one was to get good vacuums, and that didn't come in until about 1980. And Jacques Dubochet was one of the first people who realized that and had a microscope in 1980. At that point, you have to take electron micrographs, images of the structure. Once you cool it to liquid nitrogen temperature, often the liquid nitrogen is boiling, so you get vibrations, and the images were blurred. And so the cold stages that work now and had a good vacuum didn't give high resolution, so then you needed cold stages. And so then once we had a vacuum and then we had cold stages, it turned out the electron source, which was usually a bent piece of tungsten wire, just like in an old-fashioned tungsten electric light bulb, that did not give a very bright source of electrons. And so in the electron optics of the focusing, that meant that the so-called coherence of the illumination was not high enough. So then they had to go from tungsten sources to field emission guns, which are 1,000 times brighter, much sharper point, and then you get much higher resolution data. That came in the 1990s. And that, after we had vacuum stages and field emission coherent sources, it turned out the detector needed to be improved. And that was where, up to that point, up until about 2010, film, old-fashioned photographic film, you put the electrons in, it goes dark just like with light. That was the best way of recording images. And so from in the last 20 years or so, the big improvement has been in the detectors. And that came in about probably 6 or 7 years ago. And then that made all of the different barriers had then been overcome. And you could then start taking images which were much more beautiful. And then all the people who did computer-based image processing developed better programs to deal with the better images with all the better microscopes and so on. And so that's made a big revolution. So now the electron cryomicroscopy has become the dominant method in structural biology. If you open the journals now, there's still a very, very large amount of work done by NMR and X-ray crystallography, but all the difficult projects and all the ones that have a high profile are all being done by electron cryomicroscopy now, because all of these technical problems have now been largely overcome. There are still quite a few more problems to be solved that will make the method even more powerful. So it's still on a rising level of expectation.
What about the issues with the negative staining method and other sample preparation techniques? Why researchers were interested in vitrified water? And what were Jacques Dubochet's breakthroughs between the 70s and 80s?
So Jacques Dubochet started out as a young research student in Switzerland, probably about 1970. And I think he always knew that there was great potential in developing the methods further. And he was recruited to the European Molecular Biology Lab in Heidelberg in 1978 by John Kendrew, who used to be our head of division here in structural studies here at Molecular Biology Lab in Cambridge. And both John Kendrew as the director and Jacques Dubochet as a young group leader in 1978, their goal, which they stated before any work started, was to develop methods of making frozen biological specimens and to develop microscopes that would work, cryomicroscopes that would work with frozen specimens. And so they put a lot of resources, effort, and money from the European Molecular Biology Lab into that from 1978, probably till 10 years later when Dubochet went back to Switzerland. So he was there for 9 or 10 years, and they developed two things. They developed one of the very first electron cryomicroscopes that were essentially homemade with some commercial components. So they, for example, they had a very large liquid helium cooled superconducting objective lens from the Siemens company in Germany that used to make electron microscopes, and they put that into a Zeiss electron microscope. Zeiss was another, two German companies, Neither of them do make electron microscopes anymore. But in 1980, they built a microscope like that. And then in parallel, Jacques Dubochet and his group, mainly Alistair McDowell and Mark Adrian, they were the three colleagues that worked together. They were studying the properties of water when you cool it, depending on how fast you cool it. And they showed, probably about 1980, that when you cool water to liquid nitrogen temperatures, depending on how you carry out the procedure, you end up with either hexagonal ice, which is the same kind of ice you get in snow on a pond in winter in just when you walk outside, or in snowflakes, or cubic ice, which are more microscopical, or if you cool it rapidly enough, you can get amorphous ice. Their method that they developed was to make a thin film of water, perhaps fraction of a micron thick, fraction of a micrometer thick. And they did that by putting a drop of liquid onto one of the electron microscope grids that are 2 or 3 millimeters in diameter, and they simply blotted it with a piece of filter paper so that the liquid came off, but it left a meniscus that was very thin. And that was Mark Adrian's, the filter paper method. And then Alistair McDowell tried plunging the thin film of water into various media. And if you plunge it into liquid nitrogen, that's liquid nitrogen is at its boiling point. So when you put a thin film of water or a metal grid into it, the water boils and you get a thin film of gas. So it cools rather slowly and you get hexagonal ice. But if you put the thin film into liquid ethane at a temperature just above liquid nitrogen, let's say so minus 185 Celsius, it has about 100 degrees, 150 degrees between the freezing point and the boiling point, and that remains liquid and it cools it very rapidly. So in a fraction of a millisecond, you've gone from water at room temperature down to amorphous ice at liquid nitrogen temperature. And that meant that you don't get any crystals. You get the molecules beautifully preserved in this homogeneous medium. And so in the 1980s, Dubochet's group was the only one in the world doing this. And he published many papers, but in one review, they had 20 or 30 different biological structures, all looking beautiful, but not at very high resolution. So they developed the method, and that plunge-freeze method is still used today. But instead of doing it by hand, you now buy a machine. And there are about six companies that make what's called plunge-freeze instruments, in which there's a computer that controls the temperature, the humidity, the plunge-freeze rate, the blotting rate, and so on. So that was how the method was developed, and that is the method we still use. Many people now think there must be a better way of doing it, and there are a few people trying this, but at the moment, nobody has made a better method.
But let's move to data analysis. How can we reconstruct a 3D structure from single 2D images? Can you talk about Joachim Frank's work on the development of image processing techniques to achieve this?
So Joachim Frank was the third person who shared this chemistry 2017 Nobel Prize. His background was rather different. So he came from the core of the German electron microscopy community, having done his PhD in Martinsried with Walter Hoppe. And so his background was all electron optics and coherence and things like that. But probably around about 1976 or 1977, he started to think more seriously about computational analysis of images. And whereas transition from being an X-ray crystallographer to being an electron microscopist came through crystals. So I went from 3D crystals to two-dimensional crystals. Dubochet went from electron optics into image processing of single molecules. And originally in the 70s, all the single molecules that you could look at were all negatively stained or shadowed. And so all the early
work of Joachim Frank, probably up to about 1990, was done on negatively stained specimens. And that allowed them to develop many of the computational procedures whereby you take a two-dimensional image, like a photograph, and by analyzing it in the computer, end up with a three-dimensional model of that structure, because each two-dimensional image is a view of the molecule from different directions. And they call this, for example, in whole body imaging, for example, if you have some medical problem like a cancer tumor, and you know, let's say that's in your lung or in a brain tumor or so on, you go into the hospital and they use X-rays to take two-dimensional projection images from all the different angles. And when you put those together in the computer, all those different angles, there are various algorithms. And Joachim Frank was the developer of some of these algorithms. Other people developed other algorithms. The emphasis of Joachim Frank was always on the single particles. And then Dubochet developed the plunge freezing method also for single particles, but in ice. And so when these methods were brought together, you ended up with single particle electron cryomicroscopy, which is the method that's become quite powerful. And so those two contributed different, you could argue, different components of what had to be put together to make a more powerful method. Whereas my trajectory came from three-dimensional crystals and X-ray crystallography through two-dimensional crystals and electron microscopy, the same kind of cryo, electron cryomicroscopy, but it wasn't with plunge freezing, it was just with 2D crystals and so on. And then my transition again came probably in the 1990s, when it became clear that the real power of electron microscopy is not to use it as a method of getting diffraction patterns, which is what all the X-ray crystallographers and all the electron crystallographers have been doing, but the images were the most powerful thing. So in the end, everyone converged on identifying where the key route to making progress was. And then I guess throughout the late 1990s, early 2000s, people were focused on that. Computer programs were written. And then when the new detectors came in, everybody was kind of ready to go. And then from 2013 to 2019, now there's been a sort of exponential growth in the number of people, either new people being trained or structural biologists with other types of skill transferring into the electron cryomicroscopy community.
In 1975, you published a paper in Nature titled "Three-Dimensional Model of Purple Membrane Obtained by Electron Microscopy." And 15 years later, you published another paper on the same structure, but you have achieved a higher resolution. So can you talk about your work on the purple membrane and how were you able to achieve that resolution?
When I was a younger scientist, as a postdoctoral visitor in the USA at Yale, I had worked previously on the structure of enzymes using X-ray crystallography, but many people were beginning to be interested in proteins that were in membranes, but it was not so clear how you could do that work. So I did spend a couple of years trying to work on a membrane protein family called voltage-gated ion channels, but it was clear then that that was going to be take a very long time. The methods weren't available. Cloning hadn't been, you know, you couldn't purify things. So I was looking for a simpler protein that would be more suitable for structural biology. And then a group led by Walter Stickinius, who was then in San Francisco, had discovered this purple membrane, which has one small protein in it, and it's colored purple because it has, in addition to the protein polypeptide chain, it had what's called a chromophore, so vitamin A aldehyde, so the same thing that's in, as a sort of dimer in carotene in carrots, for example, it makes the carrots orange colored. Half of carotene makes vitamin A aldehyde. One of those molecules is in bacteriodopsin, and when it binds to the protein, it changes from yellow to purple. And that protein in the membrane of the bacterium absorbs light, pumps hydrogen ions, protons out of the cell, creates membrane potential, and then that allows the cell, gives it an energy source so it can swim around and live. So that was a very good membrane protein that was more tractable in, I thought, in 1972 or 1973. So when I came back from the USA to the UK, to Cambridge, to this lab in 1973, the idea initially was to make crystals and do X-ray crystallography. But I met another group leader who is still here, Nigel Unwin, and his background was in electron microscopy. He had worked in the Department of Material Science and Metallurgy in Cambridge. And then he had come here to try to develop electron microscopy methods for biology. We met up and we collaborated for about 2 years, and without any cryo, so it was all room temperature, we managed to get reasonably good images of the purple membrane with this single protein in it. The protein is called bacteria or rhodopsin because it resembles, it's not identical, but it resembles the pigment at the back of our eye in the retina, rhodopsin that's used, the visual pigment for human vision. So it's sort of bacterial, but it wasn't bacterial vision. It was bacterial energy transduction. And so we got a 7-angstrom structure, which showed alpha helices in the protein, just like they had found in myoglobin in 1957. And so when we published that 1975 paper, we copied the title. So the original paper was the structure of myoglobin using X-ray crystallography. So we said, okay, the structure of purple membrane using electron microscopy. And in 1975, we were pleased. It was the first membrane protein structure. It showed transmembrane helices. We were very pleased with that. But nothing that we did said that the resolution should be only 7 angstroms, should be low. In principle, we put the specimen in the microscope, we take a picture, it should diffract to any resolution you want. So we actually spent quite a long time trying to work out why it didn't go to a higher resolution, because then we'd get the atoms and we could get the chemistry and the structure and so on, the mechanism. And in the 1970s, we actually thought the main thing was maybe the film wasn't very good. And then after the film, we said, well, maybe the instruments that digitize the image on the film scanners, they weren't so good. So we spent years trying different films, building better and better film scanners and so on. And then we tried other methods. We tried to, instead of taking images, we thought we could take diffraction patterns and use the methods that the X-ray crystallographers had developed, all indirect. And none of these turned out to be powerful enough. And it was in the end, it was the development of the cryo microscope. So Dubochet was one of them, Bob Glaser, several people developed cryo microscopes. And then through the 1980s, we had one here, it wasn't as good. I went to Berlin, Berkeley in San Francisco, and EMBL in Heidelberg, where Dubochet had this liquid helium lens. So there were 3 microscopes, and we got images from all of them, and they all went into the analysis. And so using the very early prototypes, homemade electron microscopes, collaborating with these 3 groups, we finally got enough data to get an atomic model in 1990. So that was, it's 15 years, but you know, it wasn't all, it was 15 years. We were doing different things at each stage, trying to get to the bottom of why it wasn't working. And then in the end, we got a structure, but we needed many images and many molecules. And we realized probably 1990 that although it had worked and we got a structure, and this is a kind of model of the structure, this was made soon after that, actually, has about 5 or 6 side chains, and it's got this long molecule in the middle is the vitamin A aldehyde. We realized that the methods, although we'd got a structure, they were still the amount of signal that you extracted from the image, it was a tiny, tiny proportion of what you ought to. So we reckoned we used about 5,000 times more data than we really needed. And so although it was working, the improvements that came after that made a 1,000-fold improvement. So if you were to try and do this again, it would take you just a not very long, an hour or two. It took 15 years or something like that. So the methods and the instruments and all the equipment and computational methods, they've all greatly improved now.
You also wrote a review on radiation damage where you compare different radiation sources, electrons, neutrons, and X-rays. Can you tell us a bit about that paper and what was the motivation?
The group I was part of and trying to push in different directions, we knew what the weak points were and we were working on them. But in a way that review was a sort of slight diversion in that in parallel with the development of all the electron microscopy, electron cryomicroscopy methods, which always looked like it had a lot of potential, there were other people developing other methods. And so, for example, X-ray crystallography had originally used electrons to produce the X-rays by firing electrons into a piece of copper. And then you get the X-rays out and you shine them at crystals, you get patterns. That was back in the 30s. And then they wanted brighter X-ray sources, so they developed rotating anodes where you made the anode move so that it didn't melt when you put the beam in. You get more X-rays. But eventually it was discovered that you could get much brighter, millions of times brighter X-rays out of the synchrotron radiation that comes from electrons going around in circles. Just because they're being accelerated, they produce X-rays, and they're very powerful. So around about, probably about 1980, there was the first synchrotron dedicated to producing X-rays rather than doing particle collisions, was at Daresbury in the UK. And then Europe got together and decided to build one in Grenoble. That's the European Synchrotron Radiation Facility. And once they've built the synchrotron, they have to decide what kind of cameras and what kind of specimens they're going to look at. And one of the things synchrotrons can do very well is X-ray microscopy. And so there was a meeting at Grenoble that was run by Andrew Miller and Carl Brandane, who were the biological sciences director and ex-director. They were running the meeting. And they wanted to know whether it's a good idea to build an X-ray microscope. And because I had come from X-ray crystallography and I was doing electron microscopy, we knew all about it, radiation damage and so on. I had published papers about it before. So I was asked to go along and give a talk explaining about how much radiation damage you get with electrons, how much you get with X-rays. And the bottom line was that electrons are 1,200 times better than X-rays. And so I gave this talk, and there were 50 people in the audience. They all were X-ray microscopy people. They were really very angry because, they wanted 5 or 10 million euros to build their synchrotron beamline for X-ray microscopy. And I'm telling you, this is a really bad idea. You can do quite good X-ray microscopy, but not on molecules and atoms, but on cells and so on. They did get their beamline in the end, but because they didn't understand this, I thought, well, if 50 clever, physically oriented scientists don't know this, perhaps it would be a good idea to write a review. So I thought I'll write a review just comparing X-rays and electrons in terms of radiation damage and resolution. Although I'd published papers before about it, obviously they hadn't noticed them and so on. So I wrote this review, and then during that time, there's another journal called Neutron News. And we used to do some neutron diffraction as well. That's slightly useful in structural biology. And because we did one experiment and published one paper in 1984, every few months I still get a journal called Neutron News. And while I was writing this review about X-rays and electrons, Neutron News arrived with a center. You opened it, and it had a big full-scale table, every single element, every single isotope, telling you its lifetime and how it interacted, neutron cross-sections, elastic, and so on. And so I thought, maybe I should expand it to be electrons, X-rays, and neutrons. And my surprise was that not only are electrons 1,200 times less damaging for the information you get in the images than X-rays, They're also three times less damaging than neutrons, even though neutrons have a very weak interaction. And so I thought that was very good. So after having written that and published it, I thought, well, maybe we should, since electrons are so clearly better, perhaps we should do some more calculations. So it had added into it, if you then now focus on electrons, what is the genuine theoretical potential? So assuming all practical problems, which is what we've been working on, microscopes, vacuums, sources, detectors, supposing they all worked perfectly and we had phase plates and so on, how well would it do? And it came out that you'd do very well. And so after writing the review for a different purpose, we decided, okay, we would give up all crystallography and switch entirely into the single particle electron cryomicroscopy. So from about 1995, 96, that's what we did. And for example, people came to work. There was a visitor called Sriram Subramaniam, who now does electron cryomicroscopy. He came and we said, okay, in 1 year, we're going to do 10 structures all at atomic resolution by electron cryomicroscopy. And then we started, but we discovered, of course, that there were quite a lot of problems that needed to be solved. And that took another 15 years or something like that. But, you know, essentially the vision was there and the theoretical underpinning was there in that review. So it was even though it was done for a different purpose, it served a number of purposes afterwards.
And so do you think we still need synchrotrons for structural biology, perhaps for small molecules?
Do we need synchrotrons? Yes. And not only for small molecules, actually. They have been greatly improved. I mean, the intensity of the X-ray beams or any electromagnetic radiation that you get out of synchrotrons compared to, say, 1980, they have been increased many millionfold. So the quality of the X-rays you get out of synchrotrons is really fantastic now, and it's still being improved. So nearly all the synchrotrons in the world, they've been running for, you know, the state-of-the-art ones, they've been running for 20 years. Periodically, they shut them down, and they rebuild the magnets and the focusing elements to make it brighter and brighter. And so at the moment, the ESRF, the same one that I went to that meeting about, it is currently being upgraded. And that means that if you have a crystal, and let's say in 1960s, it would take you months to collect one three-dimensional data set of all the diffraction from the different angles in a crystal. That you can do now in 1 second instead of, you know, months. So you can collect, if you have a crystal of a biological structure you're interested in, you can solve it in minutes now. And so one of the big uses of X-ray crystallography at the moment is if you are looking to develop a new small molecule drug, let's say an oral pill that you take to cure you of, I don't know, stomach ulcers or heart problems and so on. Usually the biological target, which would either be a human protein or a bacterial protein if it's an antibiotic and so on. And let's say you're analyzing that protein, you make a crystal of the protein, you can then add to the crystal the drug that you're trying to develop and determine in a minute or so, you can determine the structure of the enzyme with your small molecule binding to it. And that small molecule might either block the activity of that biological molecule, or it could activate it, depending on what it is that you're trying to do. And then once you've got one molecule, the pharmaceutical companies, they usually make hundreds, if not thousands, before they get one that has all of the qualities that they're looking for to make a really good treatment for some human disease or ailment and so on. And so the structural biologists would like to determine the structure of hundreds of these compounds. And the great thing about synchrotrons, the brightness of the X-ray beams is so big, and the detectors are quite good, they can always be improved, they can do 300 structures every day. Whereas with electron cryomicroscopy at the moment, it's about one structure per day. Now, obviously, you can make the detectors bigger and faster and the electron microscopy will get better and better, but you'll still have this advantage that once you've got a crystal, it's very quick to do different complexes with different small molecule ligands. So synchrotrons will just get brighter and brighter. Probably we have enough of them. It's just that they all need to be continually improved. And then one of the new, let's say, directions that have been developed, instead of having a synchrotron that makes all the electrons go in a circle and produces X-rays coming out in all directions, or other electromagnetic radiation coming out in all directions, there are now linear, what they call free electron laser synchrotrons, where you accelerate the beam using a radio frequency magnetic wave to accelerate electrons, and as they go faster and faster, this is Wakefield essentially wave. So you get, along with the electrons, you get the X-rays that go with them, and then coming out of the end, you have a very, very much brighter and more powerful X-ray beam and an electron beam. And of course, the electrons, you can just divert them away with an electron field, and you get a pure pulsed electron beam. And that these are even more bright than the let's say, what they call third generation synchrotrons. But it's a technique and a brighter source looking for problems where it can be used to solve. So the synchrotrons will never go away. They'll always be needed. And in structural biology, electron microscopy is still not producing every year. Let's say, for every electron cryomicroscope structure that is deposited in the public databases, of course, it could be done by no other method. You're getting at the moment 8 or 9 structures being deposited by X-ray crystallography, although many of them are sort of related structures, so they've been repeats with slightly different ligands and so on. So the idea is that as the methods improve, the X-rays will get brighter, the electrons will get faster, the detectors will get it. We think if you look at the statistics and how people are deciding to spend their time in the structural biology field, it looks like in about 4 or 5 years, the number of structures being deposited will be about the same from electron cryomicroscopy and X-ray crystallography. And then after that, so that's 5 years from now, we already know probably about half of the structures in biology, we have atomic models, either for the structure you're interested in or a very closely related one. So probably within 5 years, you'll find that most of the landscape of structural biology has been mapped, and there are in the databases examples of nearly all the biological structures you'll be interested in. So for example, Bacteriodopsin now, there was one structure in 1990. Now, if you look in the database, there's 200 of them with different ligands, different mutants, different intermediates trapped. And many of the enzymes, you'll find that there's 1,000 different examples of them. So as the methods get more powerful, you can, instead of just saying, I would like to know the structure, and you get one structure and it takes years, now you can look at the structure, how it behaves, what its mechanism is, how it interacts with other molecules and so on. So there will be a broadening of the, let's say, the landscape and the ambitions of the structural biologist to tackle problems that are in addition to just finding out what the basic structure is.
What do you think about facilities such as the CM01, the EBIC, and the IPSIC? How do they play a role in the community?
As the use of X-ray diffraction grew in the structural biology community, both for structural biology and for chemistry and physics, material science, and so on, it became clear that people couldn't have a synchrotron in every lab because they cost £400 million to build it. And so from about 1980s or 1990s, the idea of having national facilities. So in the UK, we have one synchrotron. France has one synchrotron. Germany has one synchrotron. Europe has a bigger synchrotron. America has about 3 or 4. Japan has 2 or 3 and so on. There are probably 20 or 25. Italy has one and so on. Synchrotrons in the world that are all national or regional facilities. And so in the UK, they were probably the first one. Two scientists here Dave Stewart, who's based in Oxford, Helen Sable, based in London, about 10 years ago, they decided actually that electron microscopy was also beginning to become more expensive and that they couldn't justify one microscope costing £5 million in every lab. So they advocated and succeeded in getting funding, some grant from the Wellcome Trust, which is a UK-based charity, to buy the first high-end 300 kilovolt electron cryomicroscope. It was going to be based at the synchrotron, and they would use the management system they had developed over 10 years for applying for access to the synchrotron beamlines. They'd use the same thing for electron microscopy. And particularly Dave Stewart advocated, as part of an upgrade to the synchrotron, where they were building one long beamline. So one of the 30 beamlines was a long beamline, and it's there. And so at the end station for a long coherent X-ray beamline, they made a big building that was also for electron microscopy, so several thousand square meters. And half of it was supposed to be for electron microscopy tied to physical sciences. That's EPSIC. And the other half was tied to the biological sciences. And Wellcome, when they funded the first microscope, said, you cannot have a national facility with one microscope, because if it goes wrong, it won't work. You need two. So they were persuaded that they applied for one and they were given two. And now, of course, because it's such a successful and popular method, two is not enough. And so they're now up to five plus one or two other microscopes. So they've got about seven or eight in EBIC. And it is now, quite a successful, fully integrated with the synchrotron, the same beamline allocation panels. And so the idea now, I think, is that the very expensive microscopes that are successful, and many people who are just the users, they don't want to know anything about it. They just want to get, here is my protein, I want the structure. And they don't want to know anything. They're just users, just like having your DNA sequenced in a plasmid and so on. And so these national facilities are here to stay, and many countries have decided to co-locate them with the synchrotrons because of the common underlying infrastructure to manage it. And so Stanford in the USA has got an EM center now alongside its synchrotron. Brookhaven in the East Coast of America is thinking of doing that. But there are also national centers for EM that are not at synchrotrons. And again, we don't know quite how things will develop, but it's a good model for basing it on synchrotrons. And so here in this lab, we have three of these high-end microscopes. And we are debating, is it a good idea for us to be running a big facility like that, or should we integrate it with other national facilities? And in the UK, because the UK has been a leader in this type of electron microscope, one of the leaders, there are now 20 or 21 of these high-end microscopes, so two in Leeds, one in Glasgow, one in Leicester, and so on. So they are distributed, but the biggest number are in Oxford. They have six or seven of them there.
What I find interesting is the interaction between scientists working in research centers, and such as the LMB, and companies developing detectors or microscopes, for example. However, the companies and research centers might have different objectives, and the development of the cryo-EM would not have been possible without such collaborations. So can you tell us a bit about mutual benefits and interests and how these collaborations are developed, managed, and sustained? And are there any shared patents?
Yes, all of these things. So. Clearly, in any field, there are new discoveries, and usually it's the people in academic or research institutions that are making the basic fundamental discoveries. And it's all done with one-off, with prototype instrumentation developed. And they make it work, and they get the results, and then they publish the papers. And the skills that you need for doing that type of work are completely different from what you need to manufacture 500. The philosophy of most university departments, research institutions like the MRC Molecular Biology Lab, is that any new development, whether it's protein sequencing, DNA sequencing, protein crystallography, electron cryomicroscopy, and so on. The idea is to develop the first one or two prototypes, and then you spin it out into a company, either a small company or it gets licensed to a big company. And that's been happening certainly in our lab, but in most academic labs for 50 years or something like that. And so Ernst Ruska, when they developed the electron microscope, it was the early German companies, Siemens and Zeiss, that developed it. There were at one stage 20 companies making electron microscopes in the world. Then it obviously competition has dropped it. Now there are only three doing the really expensive ones, but there are many others doing small ones. So usually, as soon as something has been a success and one or two papers have been published, there is now in most universities or research labs, you have a technology development or technology transfer part of the organization. And in round about 1990, for example, when we were starting the CIEM, the MRC wasn't so advanced in that. There were maybe three or four people that gave advice about patents. And usually you would patent something and then the patent would be licensed and then a company would take it up. But because of, let's say, government encouragement and the need to get more money in, these technology transfer departments have grown in size. And so now all of the MRC inventions, patents, royalties, and so on, company startups, is done with a group that used to be called MRC Technology, and it was wholly managed by the MRC, but it was a charity itself. So that has now been separated, and all of our patents and company startups and so on is done through a company called LifeArc now, which has about 150 people, so not four anymore, 150 people. And they have, from this lab alone, started about 20 companies. And usually the scientists that are involved in making the fundamental discoveries, they are often the founders of the company. So they would begin by spending part of their time. For example, we had one scientist, Jonathan Karn, who had an idea for a company called RiboTargets, and he spent 5 years continuing his work for the MRC, 50% of his time, and the other 50% he went to a company on one of the science parks near Cambridge to start the company. And then that company has gone on. There's been a lot of companies like this. The most successful one has been Cambridge Antibody Technology that Greg Winter started. That was then taken over by AstraZeneca. So usually these small companies, they grow to a certain stage and then they get bought. They could go on. One of the biggest ones, Celltech, was one of the first companies started by the MRC. That's now part of a Belgian company called UCB Pharma. For example, with the detectors, we were involved in developing one of the detectors as an academic consortium in collaboration with a group at the Rutherford Appleton Laboratory that's co-located with the Diamond Synchrotron. And so they spent from about 2003 to 2008 developing a prototype direct electron detector that was then licensed to the company that's now Thermo Fisher. It's called Falcon 1, 2, 3, 4 and so on. And so I think the sensors still come from the same foundry that made them before, but it's spun out so that you have service engineers, salesmen, there's a whole infrastructure of companies. So I think there's a lot of synergy between the discovery end and the development end and then the, let's say, providing a service end to it. And so now I think Thermo Fisher, they've sold about 150 of these high-end Krios microscopes. And much of the technical development will have been done inside the company. But many of the components, for example, the field emission guns, the detectors, there are face plates that give you better contrast and so on. These are all academic developments that have been folded into what is a commercial product. And then you do need some competition. Otherwise, if you only have one company, the price, as if by magic, continues to go up. And so when it gets too expensive, people say, oh, I think we should perhaps start another company. And then, so I think it's not different. Scientific research, scientific instrumentation is not different from, my view, it's not really different from selling bread or toothpaste. They're products eventually, and then you have to make them work well. Like the new cars nowadays are far, far better than the cars you would buy 50 years ago. Much more reliable, they are much more efficient, they are, much more pleasant to drive. So the same is true of the scientific instruments, the microscopes. And you need it to be commercialized because you get the economy of scale. Whereas academics, they make one, and by the time they've made the third one, they're already bored. And then they're not doing it very well, and it's expensive too. So you need the efficiency. So I think most academic departments or research labs now have upfront, clearly stated policies. The scientists are encouraged to do their research, publish their papers, but they're also encouraged, if they have a bright idea, to spend a bit of their time developing it so that it becomes a greater benefit to a wider number of people.
Can you tell us a bit about your activities as entrepreneur?
Okay, so I wasn't specially personally involved in entrepreneurial activity, but in the 1970s, the philosophy then was the academics and the research labs, we should just do our work, publish our papers, and then someone else will read them, and then they will start a company. But in 1975, Cesar Milstein and George Kohler discovered this way of fusing antibody cells from a mouse or a human with cancer cells. And so they made fused cells, they called hybridomas, which produced forever one pure antibody. And they said in their paper, they published it in Nature, they said, they thought this might be quite useful in diagnostic or therapeutic medicine. And they did try to patent it, but they were told that there's nothing about it that it should be patented, you should go ahead and patent it. But later on, it turned out to be very important. And so now it turns out that most of the highest effective and new and expensive drugs on the market, almost all are these hybridomas. But with further developments that have happened. But so when it became clear that this was going to have a major impact on industry and pharmaceutical research, the MRC was criticized back in 1980 for not having patented it. Then the culture changed from one in which everyone published it and got on with their work and someone else did the development, to encouraging people explicitly, the scientists who work here, to, alongside their normal work, to patent things, to suggest, or maybe even to start their own company. The first one was Celltech, about 1982, which commercialized diagnostic monoclonal antibodies against all the human blood group antigens. And that grew lots of people from the LMB. Two people who were group leaders resigned their jobs and went to be chief scientific officer and business officer and so on, running the company. And then many other people went there as technicians and so on and so on. So it grew, and that still exists as UCB Pharma. That's still part of their drug. But that then brought in the idea that government-funded labs ought to take an interest in development, exploitation, company startup. So since then, there's been about 20 companies, maybe more, from LMB itself that have been, and then probably more than half of them have developed into quite successful companies. And for example, Greg Winter he started three companies. So Cambridge Antibody Technology, Demantis, and there's another one, new one called Bicycle Therapeutics. At one stage, another colleague, Chris Tate and I, we had been working on bacteriodopsin, like you see. And then it turned out that there is a very big family of human proteins, about 400 of them, that look just like this. They all have 7 transmembrane helices, and they're in the human body. They are responsible for vision. So the red, green, blue color pigments, the dark vision rhodopsin, 4 of them are in the eye. And then in your body, things like in your heart, you have the adrenergic receptor. So when you release adrenaline, your heart beats faster. That is a protein just like this. Adrenaline binds to it, signals to the cell. And there are another 400 that do different physiological processes. So when that became apparent, and that wasn't clear until about 1985, when the first, so beta-adrenergic, 1985, turned out to have a similar sequence to rhodopsin in the eye. That was the first two. And then there was the human genome about 20 years ago. That revealed another 400 and then 400 all the facts. So it's a big, big family. So we decided we better work on this because our methods and our technology. So we worked from 1990 on G-protein coupled receptors. And I actually only did a little bit myself, but we had a group that gradually grew in size. And the group, so Gebhardt Schertler, Jade Lee, they solved the structure of rhodopsin, which was the visual pigment in cows. It was not cows rather than humans, in the 2004. But it was very difficult to get the structures for these hundreds of other GPCRs that are very important in drug development. And so at one stage in 2005, we hadn't succeeded, and obviously it was of some value. So we got a grant from a pharmaceutical company called Pfizer, 50%, and another grant from MRC Technology, that's now LifeArc. And they funded 4 people to come and work on our ideas for doing G-protein coupled receptors. And remarkably enough, it worked out really well. So after we'd been doing that for 2 years, that was Chris Tate and I, and we said, well, what should we do now? Because the grant was a 3-year grant. Shall we get another grant? Shall we have a public sector consortium where everybody's allowed? Or should we start a little company? So we said, oh, well, maybe we should start a little company because we were supposed to be doing that. And so we knew another scientist who had been in big pharma and little pharma and so on called Malcolm Weir. And just at the moment we were thinking maybe it would be a good idea to start our own little company, Malcolm Weir, his position as the chief executive officer of a company called Informatica, he was sacked, he was terminated, and so he was unemployed. So we said, oh, well, maybe not only should we start a company, but Malcolm could be the... So MRC Technology said, oh, that's a good idea. So they hired him. They paid him for 6 months as a consultant, and his job was to go and get money to start a company. And within 2 weeks, he said, oh, I've got £1 million. So he got it from venture capital or something. So anyway, that went on, and now the company is called Heptares. It's been bought by a Japanese company. It's called Sosai Heptares. It has 150 employees and is doing lots of drug development. And we've all been bought out. MRC got some money out of it. And so it has been translated into something useful.